Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Iraq's Prime Minister Maliki rejecting calls for an inclusive national salvation government in the face of the ISIS-led Sunni insurgency that is closing in on Baghdad. David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco, joins us to discuss the possibility of a grand bargain between Turkey and the Kurds as the state of Iraq appears to be on the verge of collapse. Then we'll analyze Russian President Putin's combined military, diplomatic, and intelligence strategies underway in Ukraine and the absence of any coherent US or EU strategy to counter the good cop, bad cop machinations of Russia's new Tsar, who, while simultaneously arming separatist rebels in Ukraine, is magnanimously calling on the Russian parliament to rescind its permission for him to invade Ukraine. Matthew Rajansky, the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, joins us to discuss how Putin is covertly destabilizing Ukraine while appearing to cooperate with Kiev to avoid further Western sanctions. Then finally, we will speak with Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. We will discuss the muted response in the American media and among U.S. journalists over the flagrantly unjust jailing of three Al Jazeera journalists by Egypt's military government, in contrast to the vociferous protests of journalists around the world and in the UK, where news anchors taped their mouths in protest and networks went silent on air. We will also discuss the end of Rupert Murdoch's political kingmaking in British politics, as Scotland Yard officially informed the media baron that detectives want to interview him under caution as a suspect in their inquiry into phone hacking and other crimes by his newspapers. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his forthcoming book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And with Iraq's Prime Minister Maliki rejecting calls for an inclusive national salvation government in the face of this ISIS-led Sunni insurgency that seems to be closing in on Baghdad, I guess what you're talking about in your recent articles at CNBC, you're talking about a grand bargain between Turkey and the Kurds. My understanding is that John Kerry, of course, met with the Kurdish leader, at the same time cautioned the Kurds not to separate. So how do you navigate between those two positions?
It's time for a reality-based policy. I used to say that Iraq is a failed state. Now Iraq simply is a non-state. There is no military. There's no government. They've had elections, but there's no coalition in the works. It's hard to imagine Iraqis rallying and supporting its armed forces when they've caved to ISIS and surrendered so much territory in the West. So if Iraqis aren't going to do that, why would the Kurds be the ones to make the big sacrifice?
And in terms of Turkey, Turkey, of course, has its problems with the Kurds, but Turkey also clearly has problems with its foreign policy vis-a-vis Syria. It's clear, isn't it? I mean, it must be to everybody, including Erdogan, the prime minister, that this has not worked, this policy that he's had with Syria, and that, in fact, he's in many ways has helped ISIS become the problem that it is.
Yeah, Erdogan is largely responsible for what's happened. He provided sanctuary to ISIS and other jihadis. Absent any other international intervention, the Turkish government provided logistics and facilitated their transport. There was money pouring in from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, but it was really Turkey that enabled ISIS and other groups to enter the battlefield in Syria. These groups were small and insignificant, but with Turkey's help, they've now become major players, and they've demolished this border between Syria and Iraq. Their goal is to eliminate the old colonial structures and to create a new jihadi terror state, and they're well on their way.
So if the United States is not keeping up with what's happening on the ground and they're still trying to get some sense out of Maliki, which seems to be a fruitless effort, and they don't want this place to break up, even though it is breaking up, has Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey also had a wake up here? Does he realize what he's wrought and that maybe the best chance for bringing stability to that region is to work with the Kurds?
I mean, it's important for Turkey to look at its core national interests. It did $12 billion worth of business with Iraqi Kurdistan last year. On May 2nd, they opened a pipeline between Iraqi Kurdistan and the eastern Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. There are 200,000 barrels of oil being transported each day, and that's going to go up to 1 million barrels of oil. Turkey needs to have a security buffer between itself and these jihadis in Iraq. Turkey and Iraqi Kurdistan share the same interests. So does the United States share those interests. The three parties should be working together to stabilize northern Iraq and simply recognize that the rest of Iraq is lost to jihadis and Iran's proxy government in Baghdad.
But do you recognize anybody in Turkey or in the United States agreeing with what you're saying? You may be discussing something that is needed and is very sensible, but on the other hand, leaders don't act rationally. We know that from Maliki. Where's the evidence that the Turks get it?
What the Turks say and what the Turks do can be entirely different. The same thing could be said for the Obama administration. Everyone's going through this public posture right now of trying to stand up an inclusive government in Baghdad as a remedy for the country's problems. I'm sure, Ian, that behind the scenes, people are looking to cover their bets and figure out who they can work with, even if that means compromising the territorial integrity of Iraq.
So, again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his forthcoming book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. So if there is this reality check and eventually people realize that the only island of stability left in that part of the world is the Kurdish north of what used to be Iraq, Iran basically has always been the winner of Bush's war against Iraq, and they'll end up with their proxy state in the south, and assuming that you can't do much about the jihadis, even though it's misrepresented to suggest that all of this, these territorial military gains, are by ISIS. ISIS is leading it, but the Sunni tribes seem to be also engaged because they're so fed up with this government and so alienated by it. So if you write that part of the world off, you'll still have this big hole, won't you? Badlands of jihadis or stretching all the way through from Syria down to, I guess, the outskirts of Baghdad.
I mean, that's what the map is looking like. What we've seen recently are conflicts between the former Ba'athists, who were tied to Saddam Hussein, and ISIS. So there's hardly a uniform approach between the Sunnis. You know, ISIS, the Awakening, and the former Ba'athists are starting to vie for leadership positions, and we may see them beginning to conflict more and more and become a conflict within a conflict, much the way we're seeing in the Shiite South, militia groups standing up and opposing even fatwas that are being issued by Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani.
So what does this mean then? This, all of these parts of Iraq, except for the Kurdish area, will just be a roiling mess for how long to come? I mean, I'm mystified by the passivity of the Iranians. If they have so much influence, why have they allowed Maliki to screw things up so badly, and what are they doing to fix it?
I mean, Iran's real interest here is the Shia crescent that stretches from Tehran to Basra to Damascus and Beirut. This is the supply route that they use to convey weapons, to Hezbollah and other anti-Zionist organizations. So far, that hasn't been affected by these Sunni jihadis. If that supply route is interrupted, or if ISIS moves on Samarra, which is the home of the Golden Dome Mosque, one of the holiest shrines for Shia Islam, then the kind of discreet work that the Quds Force is doing is suddenly going to become much more apparent, and Iran's going to jump out of the foxhole and become an even bigger player.
But I don't understand, David Phillips. If you look at the map, it does seem that the jihadis, ISIS, and the Sunni Awakening have cut across those supply lines between Basra and Lebanon and Syria. I mean, how are they still getting their arms through, given that all that territory has been taken in the west of Iraq has been taken by ISIS and the Sunni Awakening?
So part of the reason why Iran has been such a strong supporter of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad is because there's still a strip of territory that the government of Syria controls that allows the Iranian corridor and the Shia crescent to function. You know, if that's broken, or if the Shia holy shrines are attacked, then suddenly it's game over, and Iran is going to take an even more robust approach. The first thing that happened when Mosul fell it was the arrival in Baghdad of Soleimani, who is the general in charge of the Quds Force. And he orchestrated the militias during the civil war of 2008. He was a player in Iraq's internal politics, organizing operations against U.S. forces. Now, he's now in Baghdad calling the shots. He's the shadow general behind how the Iraqi government is responding.
Well, I just don't understand how they could the supply lines haven't already, one, been cut by now, and two, will not be cut. I mean, what's there to stop the ISIS from closing the door on this supply route?
So, you know, they could very well do that. They could further expand their territory. There are certain red lines that can't be crossed from Tehran's perspective. And, you know, one of them is the corridor and the Shia crescent. But Iran has other interests here. Now, there are 10 million Kurds who live in Iranian Kurdistan and in Kermanshah. And you know, if Iraqi Kurdistan, you know, makes a breakout and goes for independence, you know, the Iranian Kurds are going to want something similar. There are also divisions that have come up between the Syrian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds. So you have a map in this part of the world which is in an advanced state of collapse, with sectarian and ethnic groups trying to secure their borders and their core interests. You know, that's what makes it so volatile, and that's why this idea that you can negotiate an inclusive government in Baghdad and somehow that's going to provide an incentive to all parties to get along, to me, is just far-fetched. And the time for that has passed. U.S. leverage was lost when the Status of Forces Agreement fell apart in 2011. You know, I just think it's time to see things as they are, not as they were or how we wish them to be.
And just in closing, though, things look like they're going to get demonstrably worse, that soon, probably, Iran is going to feel that it has to act more assertively, because I can't see them continuing that supply line all the way through all this hostile territory from Iran all through Iraq into Syria.
I mean, they're going to continue to operate through Shiite militia groups in Iraq. There's very little likelihood that the Iranian armed forces are going to establish a physical presence on Iraqi territory, but they don't need to. They have their proxies. They have their militia groups. They control the government of Baghdad. Maliki is their man. He's not going anywhere. He hasn't shown any conciliatory approach to other groups. So I'm afraid we're in a stalemate with Iraq literally just falling apart, and the Secretary of State, John Kerry, making the rounds, going from leader to leader, you know, hat in hand, asking them to get along. Now, that's just simply not happening, and it's not going to happen.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his forthcoming book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of Russian President Putin's combined military, diplomatic, and intelligence strategies.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Rajansky, who is the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rajansky.
Thanks, Ian. I'm very happy to be with you.
And you were fairly recently in Russia and Ukraine, and now the West is warning Russia of new sanctions following the apparent breakdown of this ceasefire arrangement with the shooting down of a Ukrainian military helicopter killing 9 soldiers. At the same time, President Putin has the Russian parliament rescind his permission to use military force in Ukraine. So it feels to me like a good cop, bad cop routine on the part of Putin, making magnanimous gestures at the same time surreptitiously helping the rebels in eastern Ukraine.
You know, I think it has been that for quite some time. I think there's no question that Putin is quite effectively playing a game on multiple levels, call it three-dimensional chess. You know, he has a relationship with the separatist forces on the ground where he has supplied them directly or indirectly with supplies, including lethal supplies, some kind of guidance, and then a sort of moral or propagandistic blanket, thanks to the Russian media, which justifies their actions in the eyes of much of the local population that watches Russian media, and then, of course, the public in Russia itself. But then he also has a relationship with the Ukrainian leadership. He has clearly spoken quite frequently and directly, my understanding was even daily, with the new president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, whom he knows, of course. This is a long-standing leading political figure and oligarch, a billionaire in Ukraine, who has interests in Russia as well. So those two have negotiated the details of what might be required in order to change Russia's position on southeastern Ukraine. And then he has a relationship with the West. The U.S.-Russia dynamic and the Russia-Europe dynamic, particularly Russia-Germany, which he's also negotiating very carefully and using all of the different levers of his influence, including, of course, energy, namely gas, Russia's gas exports to Europe, which make up, in some cases, 80 or 100% of European, EU, and NATO member countries' energy consumption.
So clearly, Putin does not want sanctions imposed, and it would seem to me that the Europeans, and particularly the Germans, don't particularly want to impose these sanctions. So is that a part of this kabuki theater that's going on, that the Europeans don't want to impose the sanctions and Russia clearly doesn't want them, but meanwhile the United States is trying to say, well, wait a minute, we're all being had here?
I think there's a part of the dynamic when it comes to sanctions on the part of Washington as well as Europe, but but Washington more so, because I think the drumbeat for sanctions, as you indicate, has been louder from Washington. That's a little bit like a teacher trying to rein in an elementary school class, or a drill sergeant trying to impose discipline on an unruly group of recruits. The idea that somehow if you make the consequences for the ultimate outcome, that is, if the room doesn't go silent, if I hear another outburst, if someone throws another paper airplane, you're all going to suffer, right? The idea that there can be this kind of indirect responsibility, I think that's problematic, because at the end of the day, whether Putin is sincere in rescinding the authorization for military force, slightly moving Russian troops away from the border or reducing the numbers that are concentrated there, the idea that he can have kind of direct operational control, if an aircraft gets shot down, well, that was Putin either actively doing the wrong thing or omitting to do something that could have specifically stopped that from happening. That's a bit of a stretch. You know, this is not a contained environment. This isn't a single, classroom or military unit. This is an extremely complex, multi-layer environment where I think Putin's influence is very considerable. And I think it's fair to say he is not doing everything he can to resolve the conflict. But to take particular trigger points and say, this is Russia's nefarious hand, and I think that the statements by a number of U.S. officials, in particular more than European officials, have really gone over the line in terms of depicting Russia as creating this chaos directly, when in fact what it's done is uncorked the bottle, let the genie out, and it's the genie that's running amok now.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rejanski, who's the director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasian region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. So in terms of mixed signals then, is it possible that one of the reasons is what's going on within Russia and within the ruling elite itself, this circle of Siloviki that surround Putin, they seem to be his main influence, and there's been some concern expressed that he's not getting a broader range of input from others, the oligarchs and foreign policy people, as opposed to the Siloviki and the guys in uniform?
Well, I think it's frankly wishful thinking to suggest that there is a defined or a knowable group of people that we in the West can identify who have really significant influence over Vladimir Putin. I think Vladimir Putin is the decider, to take George W. Bush's term, but more than that, I think he's the Tsar. And so you can look around for the Rasputin, or you can look around for the influential vizier, but at the end of the day, he's the sovereign. He's at a point in the evolution of his political system, which is his creation. I mean, this is something he inherited from Yeltsin, but fundamentally shaped it himself. The vertical of power, the way that Russia is governed, it's a creation of Putin. It's been a decade and a half now with him at the top. And he is the Tsar. And I think what that means is his perception of reality, we may agree with it or we may disagree with it. And I think now, overwhelmingly, people in the West disagree with what he believes is going on in Ukraine, insofar as we don't think Ukraine is run by a fascist junta which was put there by the CIA, and we don't think that there's ethnic cleansing against Russians in the southeast, and we don't think that the annexation of Crimea was legal or, righting a historic wrong, but that it was in fact a naked territorial land grab against international law. All that said, Putin is ultimately going to decide what Russia's position is. And so where we run into, I think, troubled waters with sanctions is in thinking that we can game the internal decision-making system of the Kremlin. And ironically, I think we put things in exactly the reverse order. So we began to do these targeted sanctions on individuals whom we thought we could kind of split off or cause to be, cause to check Putin more, and that hasn't happened, right? To the extent that we're talking about new sanctions, analytically, by definition, the previous rounds didn't work. So what I would suggest is we really should have started from where we are now, which is let's come up with a credible way to threaten the one thing we think actually goes to Putin directly, and that's the energy sales revenue that he depends on in order to run the system that he wants to maintain in Russia. And it seems like that is now finally being threatened. Exactly how credible it is and exactly what, you know, what are the levers, what's the trigger, what are the levers by which we impose it, and then what's, you know, the so-called off-ramp, what's the door that Putin can walk through in order to turn them off. Those things have to be defined extremely clearly.
So, Matthew Rudzinski, there isn't any confusion then at the top inside of the Russian circle of leadership. He's the czar, and that our efforts to split off some of his advisors by sanctioning them and sanctioning what's referred to as Putin's bank in Leningrad, that has had little to no effect on him. What about the idea then, or at least what I was told recently by a former senior MI6 official who said that he understands that Putin and Obama actually have a very good relationship, contrary to what we've all been told, and that they speak often on the phone, and that Putin, even though they're very different, Putin actually respects Obama. You said earlier that he'd spent a lot of time talking to Merkel and other world leaders. That's one of his many faces as he deals with different pieces of this big mosaic here. Do you understand that to be true? Is there any, because it doesn't seem to be, if there's a good personal relationship between Putin and Obama, it certainly doesn't seem to be manifesting itself.
Well, it's a fascinating question, and it's not one that that I think I can answer or you can answer, or any of us who are not, you know, really on the inside. My understanding is that Obama and Putin have had, even in the worst of the Ukrainian crisis in the last few months, even after canceled summits and ejecting Russia from the G8 and sanctions, et cetera, they've still had, you know, reasonably productive phone calls, long phone calls, more than an hour, I understand, at least in one case. And it is hard for me to project exactly what might be going on in those phone calls. Now, admittedly, there's room for sort of translation that probably slows things down. But, you know, you've got to have an awful lot to say to each other in order to stay on the phone for that long when you think about kind of the price of these two people's time, which is probably the highest in the world. And so my sense is they at least have the ability to dialogue and to do diplomacy, maybe not ultimately successfully, but they can engage in the process on the most important issues, on the things that both of them care about, which is probably not only Ukraine, right? Syria, Iran, Afghanistan, perhaps even Iraq, are almost certainly on the table between Russia and the United States now. Now, the twilight zone aspect of where we are in the U.S.-Russia relationship is that that might be happening at a very senior level. It may even be happening at lower levels, but not reported so much. Certainly it's happening between Kerry and Lavrov, the foreign ministers. And yet, officially, the Bilateral Presidential Commission, which was created after the reset in 2009 in order to facilitate exactly that kind of cooperation, multi-agenda cooperation, you know, from energy and security issues all the way to environmental protection and health, has been officially frozen by the U.S. side, along with sanctions. Obviously, the U.S. side is going after the personal assets and even in some cases the family members of some of these targeted, you know, so-called Putin inner circle individuals in Russia. So there is an apparent cognitive dissonance between the way the relationship is being conducted at very high levels, where I think people do understand they need to talk to each other because Russia's not going away. The president has tried to dismiss Russia as merely a regional power, and I thought that the response of the Russian ambassador in Washington to that was priceless. He said, yes, we agree Russia's a regional power, as long as you agree that the region stretches from the Sea of Japan to the Baltic and from the Arctic to the Middle East. I think that's about right.
Well, in many ways, it seems, though, that what's happening in this region, a lot of the, I guess, success, if you will, of Putin's strategies I'm not sure that we have a strategy, but not only does he seem to have a strategy, or at least he seems to be fairly nimble or keeping everybody off balance, being a former intelligence officer, it does seem that the Russians have an extremely robust intelligence activity, given that so much of this destabilization of the eastern Ukraine comes from the GRU, and the way that he took Crimea without firing a shot, the fact that Victoria Nuland's phone conversation was released at a very strategic moment. Now we have the situation in Poland, which is in essentially now a frontline state, if you're to take this as a confrontation. The release of this damaging tapes, to my mind, indicate again the fingerprints of the Russian intelligence service. Now the head of NATO is saying that member states are complaining to him that the Russian intelligence services are funding environmental NGOs in Europe, Western Europe, to demonstrate against fracking, particularly in Poland, because Russia sees its long-term strategic needs in terms of making Western Europe dependent upon Russian energy. I bring all this up, whether it's not entirely all proven, particularly in the Polish case, but there's certainly a lot of smoke if there's not any fire. The point being that it would seem to me that Russia has a strategy on various levels, and I'm not sure what we have in response and what NATO has in response.
Well, there's a lot in that question, as I'm sure you know, Ian, but I can say several things. First, I can say I don't think that the West, broadly speaking, has a strategy. I think for the United States, there's a tremendous amount of light and noise. I think that the Russia issue, Russia as an adversary, Russia as a bête noire and a justification for our presence, our robust security projection into Europe, Eurasia, is convenient for campaign rhetoric and for talk shows, but it's not something that sort of tracks with a deeper American public interest or even perhaps with national interest. That debate is not being had, at least in the United States. On the European side, there is a clear strategic interest, right? European integration has served Europe's interests like absolutely no other priority since the end of World War II. It's delivered peace and stability and economic growth for Europeans like nothing else in history. And yet, I think Europe, and certainly the European Union as an entity, lacks a strategic vocabulary, right? They have these tools like the association agreements that they've offered to former Soviet republics in Eastern Europe, and they kind of march down the path of a real strategic agenda without talking and thinking in strategic terms, with a few exceptions here and there, like Radek Sikorski from Poland, who finally, you know, in November of last year, as the whole Euromaidan protest movement was exploding in Ukraine, he finally said what should have been said at the beginning, which is this is basically EU membership. That's basically what's being offered. Instead, it was a kind of bureaucratic falling backwards into a strategy. So there really isn't any semblance of a strategy on the Western side. On the Russian side, I think you have to be careful not to elide the issue of strategic thinking and kind of an ideological vision. So I'm certain that Mr. Putin, again, being the Tsar, being in a position where no matter where he came from, yes, he has this origin as an intelligence officer. Yes, on certain levels, he is still probably a regular guy. But he's not in a position now where anyone can come to him and say, you know what, Vladimir Vladimirovich, you think it's black, it's actually white. You know, people are afraid around him. The way he has managed the system has been exactly in order to drive fear into the heart of anyone who might have power and knowledge and influence. And so I don't think he necessarily gets the kind of strategic level perspective that allows him to formulate a really, you know, well-developed, thought-out strategy. Instead, I think what he has is an ideological conviction that, A, NATO is Russia's enemy, and that the United States has been driving the expansion of an anti-Russian alliance around Russia's periphery. B, that Ukraine really is not a country, that Ukraine really is a kind of accidental creation of Russia's absenteeism after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that basically Russia needs to take that space back in some form or other, either overt annexation like Crimea or simply integration into a Russian-dominated union of some kind, as in the Soviet Union or with this new customs union. And I think he has a a kind of deep conviction about his own place in Russian history, that there are really great Russian rulers, and then there are forgettable Russian rulers. And he, I think, believes that he has crossed into the realm of the really great rulers. You know, the Peter the Greats, the Catherine the Greats, those who gathered together the Russian lands and restored the glory and greatness of Russia. Is that a strategy? I'd hesitate to call that a strategy, but it's certainly a vision.
Well, there's great and there's great. I mean, a lot of people think Stalin was a great leader, right?
Right. And by the way, I mean, during World War II itself, there was a real debate about whether, you know, the basic capabilities that the Soviet Union should have had, for example, competent military officers, you know, at the field grade and below, that it didn't have those precisely because of Stalin's vision. You know, Stalin had an idea about who should lead the Soviet Union, and it was not the experienced military officers. So that's exactly where vision and strategy part ways. And I think Putin's vision for the greatness of Russia is now, at this moment, promoting people who lack the kinds of basic competencies that will make Russia economically competitive, prosperous, and stable for the next several decades. That's a real problem for Russia. And by the way, that's a real problem for the United States and the West. I think we need to avoid triumphalism about Russia's kind of hollowness, about the instability of the Putin system, and say, oh, well, they're on the wrong side of history, so they're going to lose anyway. Well, you know what? When they lose, we're all going to lose. And that's a real problem.
Well, Matthew Rudzinski, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rudzinski, who's the director of the Cannon Institute at the Wilson Center. He's an expert on U.S. relations with the states of the former Soviet Union, especially Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova, and has advised governments, intergovernmental organizations on conflict resolution and efforts to enhance shared security throughout the Euro-Atlantic and Eurasia region. Previously, he was deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he founded Carnegie's Ukraine program. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to the UK to speak with Toby Miller about international outrage amongst journalists and protests in England, where anchors have taped their mouths, in contrast to the silence here in the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from the UK is Toby Miller, who's one of the world's leading analysts in popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Good to be here.
And I'm somewhat struck by the difference between how in many other countries, Canada, Australia, and particularly the UK, the press is reacting to the sentencing in Egypt of the three journalists. And there's virtually nothing here in the US media in terms of journalistic activism, displays of solidarity for fellow journalists who are essentially jailed for just doing their jobs. In Britain, the BBC went silent. The head of the BBC News led a protest on ITN, the independent television network, or the commercial television network. Their news anchor and all the journalists put tape over their mouths, and they went silent. You're not over here, of course, but do you have any inkling as to why it is that American journalists and their media owners aren't showing solidarity with these jailed journalists?
Well, one thing to add to what you mentioned, Ian, is that the head of BBC News is actually a former editor of the Times newspaper, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who is the head honcho of News and of Fox, of course. But I suspect that the key expression here is a two-word term. It's the network that these three journalists work for, namely Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, one of the most respected news-gathering organizations in the world, is regarded still by many in the United States, especially in journalism, as something of a dirty word, because it doesn't represent a, you know, lockstep, lickspittle attitude to U.S. foreign policy in the way that the vast majority of the conventional media do. The BBC may be very conservative. ITN, which, as you said, is the other big public service broadcaster here, although a commercial one, may be conservative. But they do have a sense of journalistic solidarity. And those photos of hundreds of BBC journalists with tape placed over their mouths, that silent protest, and much more verbal ones, have been extremely impressive and have made this a really major story here. People in Britain, where I'm living at the moment, people in Peru, where I was last week, are not interested in whether Al Jazeera takes a pro or con policy with relation to U.S. adventures in the Arab world. What they're interested in is whether or not truth can circulate, and that's how it should be.
Well, of course, in a sense, these journalists are collateral damage because of a spat between the Egyptian government and the Emir Qatar, who owns Al Jazeera. And since he can't go after the Arab Al Jazeera broadcasters because they've all been booted out of the country, he's going after the English language people. And of course, there is a difference between the English language Al Jazeera and the Arab language Al Jazeera. It is much more pro-Muslim Brotherhood, which is the reason why General Sisi is cracking down on them.
Well, that's absolutely true. The Muslim Brotherhood is the enemy of Sisi. It was, of course, the group that ran the government until the coup that he led. And there's no doubt that there are two Al Jazeeras. One is for the Arab world, and it takes very particular positions that are quite problematic on Israel, quite problematic on the Muslim Brotherhood. And then there is the English language Al Jazeera, which, in my opinion, takes a very balanced and fair-minded view. But either way, whether you have a news entity that takes balanced positions or one that doesn't, the importance of journalism is that it remain independent, at least relatively independent of government, in order that it be able to tell its story. Now, the big problem we have in the United States is not that the government exercises direct control over journalists. Our problem is that the journalists and the proprietors have too similar and too narrow a set of ideological views, so that their positions, their perspectives, are often really in step with U.S. foreign policy, and there's rarely a critical voice that gets enunciated. There'll be something that says, on the one hand or on the other hand. There'll be nothing that draws attention to the long durée of U.S. imperialism as the constant leitmotif in activities over the last 70 or 80 years. That's what we really lack. But nevertheless, it is claimed that U.S. journalists believe in the independence of journalism. And that's something that one would expect would see them operate in a really kind of union-like, solid manner in order to protect their brothers and sisters from this kind of attack. So I'm afraid it suggests that once more the Arab world is something to be reported on, not something that is regarded as producing reports itself that are worth reading.
But Toby Miller, could it also be that American journalists, because of this binary nature of in the universe of discourse, there's only two black and white opinions, and it's he said, she said, and on the one hand and on the other hand, the Republican opinion and then the Democratic opinion.
Absolutely.
Has this led to this cultural idea that, you know, having a political position, having any sort of commitment, passion, conviction, you have to eradicate that in order to be a kind of, the piano player in the whorehouse?
Well, there is a real problem with the notion of objectivity. Objectivity was introduced in the late 19th, early 20th century by newspaper proprietors in the United States as a means of preventing the state from engaging in particularly onerous censorship. And the idea was, look, we won't do too much investigation of dirty deals by the government and too much investigation of dirty deals by corporations. In return, you'll lay off from us. and we won't be pushing one particular position or another other than at election time. And that invention, sadly, even though it was just a strategic means of dealing with the threat of regulation, led to generation after generation of very faulty education being provided in journalism schools. The idea of this strategic binary that you've mentioned, there are two positions on everything, one is liberal, the other is conservative, one is Democrat, the other is Republican, one is, you know, she said, the other is he said, endlessly reiterated again and again and again. And the idea, for example, that on a topic like global warming or the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there's actually, a right story and a wrong story, and that these do not necessarily match U.S. environmental or foreign policy, is basically unsayable, because the notion of objectivity is very tightly circumscribed within very particular interests. Interests that are about the commercial well-being of capitalism, the viability of an interventionist state in the interests of U.S. corporations, and the, in a sense, inviolable nature of the legitimacy of the Pentagon to intervene in any part of the world at any time in any way.
Except Ukraine.
Well, of course, there are limits.
Right.
Anytime somebody says in any way, at any time, you know that there are going to be exceptions that show they're wrong. Right. But I think you get my general...
I do. And again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. You mentioned Rupert Murdoch. Of course, the hacking trial came to an end in England just a couple of days ago. I believe then, was it yesterday, that the British Prime Minister, given that his media guy, his right-hand man, was convicted and is yet to be sentenced, Prime Minister Cameron went to the media and made an apology, as he said he'd promised to do, and he made this apology. But now I understand that the judge in the trial has rebuked him because he's interfering with the trial because the sentencing hasn't happened. And I'm curious to know, what kind of an idiot is Cameron? I mean, doesn't he know that? Isn't that an ironclad rule in the British judiciary, and which you'd think that politicians would be quite aware of?
Well, this is all about the case of Andy Coulson, who was a major newspaper editor in the Rupert Murdoch staple, and one of whose employees was found guilty of illegal phone tapping. He left the job. He then was hired by David Cameron when David Cameron was leader of the opposition, the Conservative Party opposition, equivalent to the Republicans in Britain. And when Cameron was elected Prime Minister in 2010, he quickly brought Coulson into the camp as his major communications advisor. Now, what happened was that as a consequence of very clever investigative reporting, particularly by the Guardian newspaper, now, of course, very popular in the United States, it was disclosed that this hacking had not been a one-off operation by one journalist, but a systematic operation by many in the Murdoch staple. And in fact, right now, we're looking at the possibility of both Rupert Murdoch and his son, James, being arraigned before courts in Britain. Certainly, they're going to be interrogated under caution, as the saying goes, potentially arraigned before the courts on criminal charges. It's not clear whether that will happen or not. But what has happened is that Coulson and numerous other defendants have been tried. Some people have been exonerated. Coulson was convicted yesterday, and we're awaiting word of his sentencing. But meanwhile, Cameron, now, as I said, Prime Minister, jumped up and said, well, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. I'm terribly sorry I appointed this guy. He told me he was innocent. I believed him. It was an error of judgment. Well, the judge on the case, Mr. Justice Saunders, has described this intervention by Cameron as unsatisfactory and setting a bad example to the media because, of course, whilst the verdict has come down, the sentencing phase has not yet finished. We're going to find out early next week, it said, perhaps Monday, what, if any, time in jail Coulson will serve. And there's a suggestion it may be some considerable time. Now, it's possible that the Crown Prosecution Service, which is the entity that decides to take things to court, will actually call for a retrial as a consequence of what Cameron has done. So this is really an appalling error of judgment, an act of complete idiocy by somebody who is effectively in somewhere in between the position of Speaker of the House and President of the United States in U.S. terms, and who has media advisors and lawyers up the wazoo telling him what to do. It calls into question also exactly what he was doing in appointing Coulson in the first place, because it's been suggested that this was one more attempt to get in the good books of Mr. Murdoch, something that successive administrations in this country have done, including, of course, Tony Blair. So it's basically a foul-up from beginning to end on the part of the Conservative Party and David Cameron as its leader. I think it's a major mistake. I think that the judge calling him to task over it indicates what an incompetent prime minister he is. He's a person who shoots from the hip, who doesn't attend to detail, and who isn't a very competent administrator. But it shows us something else, which is that running not far beneath the sort of rich vein of scandal and gossip mongering in British journalism, a long-standing tradition, some of it very dishonourable, some of it honourable, lies also a systematic attempt to mislead the public, to engage in criminal activity, and to do so with the alibi reiterated endlessly by Mr. Murdoch of popularity with the public.
So, Toby Miller, my understanding is, though, that Rupert Murdoch has been officially informed by Scotland Yard that detectives want to interview him as a suspect as part of their inquiry into allegations of crimes at his British newspapers. And apparently, when this hacking scandal first broke, they wanted to interview Murdoch and his son, James, but the Murdochs said that they would do it after the trial is over, which is about now, right? So is that your understanding?
That is absolutely right. They undertook to do this, provided that the police would wait until the trial had concluded, and now it has concluded. The technical term used here is interview under caution, and what that means is rather similar to what happens with Miranda warnings and so on in the US. You don't have to say anything, but it may harm your defense if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court, and anything you do so can be given in evidence. So basically what they're saying is you can say nothing, you can take the, you know, the Fifth Amendment, as it were, but be aware that if things come up in court later where you didn't share information that you should have, it will count against you. You'll get told what your rights are. You have the right to remain silent. You're not actually arrested. But it's a serious matter, and it'll be fascinating to see what happens with Rupert bibulous and gaga most of the time, James disgraced as a complete incompetent. They could be in trouble because some of the charges they may face are not only about duplicity or mendacity, they're also about competence and incompetence. And it's quite possible that they could be charged based not on the idea that they have lied about knowing about the hacking. Obviously, I had no idea whether they know or knew about the hacking or did not, but rather that they should have known and therefore were completely incompetent. There's some companies legislation that would cover that. So it will be very interesting as to whether they do agree to the interviews, to see when they're next in the UK and how much time they're spending here, and then whether or not the Crown Prosecution Service in fact takes further action.
Well, Toby Miller, what I find extraordinary, though, is that this news corporation, Murdoch's company, which should have been, I think, thoroughly discredited, because what they did, these hacking, particularly the hacking of a young girl that was kidnapped and subsequently murdered, they actually hacked into her cell phone, deleted messages, and caused unspeakable anguish to the parents. You know, that shows that culture, the head of which Murdoch is responsible for. Yet, when the scandal erupted in July of 2011, it forced Murdoch to split off the two companies into News Corp and 20th Century Fox. But now their combined market capitalization is $85 billion, up from $48 billion on the eve of the crisis. So in terms of mammon, God may punish Rupert Murdoch, but mammon is awarding him.
Well, I'm afraid that's absolutely correct. You take on Murdoch at your peril in general. That said, his reputation in this country is in tatters, even amongst the members of the ruling class, the fraction of it, the political class that has long relied on him. I mean, you mentioned that the tragic slaying of Millie Dowler. Her sister, Gemma, has just urged all the politicians, and to use this expression, keep their promises to hacking victims by trying to undertake to change the way the press operates. But right now, there's no sign of that happening. Many of the journalists involved were on very, very high salaries, much higher salaries than conventional political journalists, but also under extremely intense pressure to perform. And perform meant not unearthing the kind of information that the Al Jazeera 3 were unearthing, but unearthing trivial information about not just the sex lives of celebrities, but the sex lives and consuming lives of very ordinary people and frequently victims of crime like Millie Dowler. So there is a cultural problem. There's also the tragedy that the man who is not necessarily the architect of the hacking, but is the architect of this kind of journalism in this country, the dominant figure in this kind of journalism in this country, namely Murdoch, can get away with it. Just as there's the tragedy that Murdoch can get away with the most excessive climate change denial imaginable in the United States, completely biased reporting about the major political parties, and a set of foreign affairs positions enunciated in everything from the Wall Street Journal editorial pages through to Fox News. That is not only trivializing, but quite dangerous given the geopolitical power and force of the United States. The fact that those views get an uncritical hearing, that they're enunciated from apparently legitimate sources, is really quite shocking. So, you know, in the long run, when we are all dead, as J.M. Keynes put it, in the long run, the verdict of history on Murdoch will be that he was a skillful journalist, because he was also that, a very able proprietor, a person who hired and fired competent and incompetent people alike, but who was very good at seeing the future technologically and in regulatory terms when it came to the spread of satellite and cable, when it came to deregulation, permitting special thematic channels, whether they be sports ones or news ones, who took the big three, ABC, NBC, CBS, by storm and surprise in the late 80s and early 90s, who was able and clever at running a variety of journalistic operations in many, many parts of the world, but who fundamentally was an unethical individual who was on the side of some of the most vicious regimes in history.
And just in closing, Toby Miller, I understand that as a kingmaker, as a political kingmaker in England, which he certainly has been since the days of Kinnock and the Labour Party, those days are over, aren't they?
Oh, I think absolutely. Whilst there are still some politicians who worry about The Sun, which is the biggest-selling daily paper here and is in the Murdoch staple, by and large, he is a discredited force. He's a disgraced figure. And never again will people tremble in his company in the way that they did. Ed Miliband, who is the leader of the opposition of the Labour Party, what was Tony Blair's party when Blair was in government today, has been prepared to get up and really stick one in Murdoch's eye very, very publicly in a way that no politician has been prepared to do for the last four decades.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is in the UK. He's one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.